Have you ever seen the cable TV show Dog Whisperer? You familiar with that? It stars Cesar Millan. And you would think that it's about how he trains dogs that are otherwise out of control. But that's really not what happens. On that show, he trains dog owners. And one of the fun parts of the show is to see how the dogs respond as their owners take on a different approach. He has said in his show that true pack leadership requires both being calm and assertive at the same time. And like dogs, people want to follow calm and assertive leaders. Leaders who are calm but not assertive are easy targets for people to ignore or take advantage of. They fail to inspire their colleagues, their customers, or even their bosses. Conversely, those who are assertive but not calm actually create anxiety at the very time they're trying to reassure people. And I'm sure all of you are by now thinking, why are we talking about this in church? Well, through this month of August, we are looking in the Old Testament book of Daniel, learning how to live as a Christian when the heat is on. We looked last time in chapter 1. We saw how Daniel and three of his friends were taken as teenagers from their home in Judah, taken 1,500 miles away to a foreign land where they were given foreign names, expected to learn a foreign language, adopt a foreign culture, and serve the government that had taken them from their homes and their families. We saw how they drew a line, not compromising their faith, and how it took creative alternatives for them to get through when the heat was on. This morning we move into chapter 2, where Daniel discovers that his life, as well as the lives of his friends and colleagues, are at stake. Once again, the heat is on. And in this case, we need calm assertiveness to get us through. So I invite you to turn in your Bibles to the passage that was read earlier, Daniel chapter 2. We are not going to go through the entire chapter today, but we are going to look at how Daniel responded in this very difficult situation. We begin as Daniel encountered an impossible demand. We see this in the opening verses of chapter 2. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled and he could not sleep. So the king summoned the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the astrologers to tell him what he had dreamed. When they came in and stood before the king, he said to them, "I've had a dream that troubles me and I want to know what it means." Now, this all begins rather normally. King Nebuchadnezzar, at this time, how many of you remember, this is probably an old saying, big man on campus, remember that? Some of us old timers. Well, King Nebuchadnezzar was the big man on earth. He was the king of the mightiest empire. In fact, to this day, many secular historians say that Nebuchadnezzar was one of the greatest kings of the ancient world. He did some amazing things during his reign. He is on top of the world, but he is troubled. As Shakespeare wrote, "Uneasy lies the head that wears the crown." And that was certainly the case for Nebuchadnezzar. Notice it says that he had dreams, plural. This wasn't just one dream. This was a recurring dream. It was happening over and over and over again. And it was really bugging him. He didn't know what it meant. And it got to the point where he wasn't sleeping. Maybe you've had that experience. Maybe you've had a dream that was frightening, almost nightmarish. And your eyes pop open in the middle of the night. You look up at the ceiling. You're trying to figure it out. Sometimes your dreams are so real, you're not sure if it's a dream or if it's a reality, right? And you try to make sense of it. And then the harder you try to go back to sleep, the more you don't sleep, right? And that's what was happening to Nebuchadnezzar. Insomnia had sunk in. And a lack of sleep will do a number on you, physically, mentally, psychologically, just across the board. It is not good. And Nebuchadnezzar was not in a very good frame of mind. So he does what he would normally do. He calls in his advisors, the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, the astrologers. Sounds like the faculty at Hogwarts, right? You know, Harry Potter's whole gang is being brought in here. You may not know this, but the ancient land of Babylon is where astrology originated. That's where it all began. And Nebuchadnezzar had what our common presidents or governors would call their cabinet. These are the advisors that would come in and help them as they rule the land. So he was looking for an answer. These were the specialists in psychic phenomena, you might say. And they were all brought in. And I'm sure this had happened before. In fact, these guys were prepared. They had great big, I would say books, but they were really scrolls, of dreams and their meanings. And they tried to anticipate every possibility. And so these scrolls are huge. And so if the king would give them what the dream was, they could look up in their scrolls and say, okay, that's what it means. But there's a twist. The specialists reply in verse 4, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream and we will interpret it. Yeah, that sounds right. And then the king says, and this is where it gets a little sticky. In the King James Version and a couple other English translations, it says, the thing has left me. Which would lead us to believe that Nebuchadnezzar had forgotten the dream. And so he wants these advisors to tell him what the dream was and then interpret it. That's not the way the original language reads, though. There's a Persian word that he uses that means certain or sure. And so the NIV translates, this is what I have firmly decided. It actually appears twice in this chapter. If you do not tell me what my dream was and interpret it, I will have you cut to pieces, your houses will be turned into piles of rubble. I like the way the New Living Translation puts this. I'm serious about this. If you don't tell me what my dream was and what it meant, you'll be torn limb from limb and your houses will be turned into heaps of rubble. He's putting the heat on these advisors. Do it or else. I want you to tell me what the dream was and tell me the interpretation. And remember, if he had forgotten the dream, how would he know if they were right? He knew what the dream was. We're going to see in a moment why he makes this impossible demand. Once again, verse 7, they reply, let the king tell his servants the dream and we will interpret it. What are they doing? What we do when we're given an impossible situation? We're buying time, right? We're just trying to see if something might change, and it's very clear it's not going to. Verses 8 and 9, Nebuchadnezzar doubles down. I am certain that you're trying to gain time because you realize that this is what I firmly decided. There's that phrase again. If you do not tell me the dream, there is just one penalty for you. You have conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things, hoping the situation will change. So then tell me the dream and I will know that you can interpret it for me. Now we're starting to get into Nebuchadnezzar's mind. You are conspiring against me. He's getting a little paranoid. Now, I don't know. Maybe these guys had given him reason for thinking that. We're not told. We find later on in the book of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar goes through what today they'd call a psychotic break, an absolute nervous mental breakdown. Maybe this is leading up to it. I don't know. But this is an impossible demand. How is anybody supposed to be able to tell someone what they dreamed, let alone what it meant? And that's pretty much how the advisors respond. They are getting a little uptight. The temperature is rising in the king's court. Verse 10, the astrologers answered the king, "There's not a man on earth who can do what the king asks. No king, however great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer. What the king asks is too difficult. No one can reveal that to the king except the gods, and they don't live among men." Basically, "Oh, king, live forever, but you're nuts." This is insane. How are we supposed to tell you what your dream was? In helpless frustration, they so much as call the king an irrational royal nutcase. And as you might expect, that did not go over real well with the king. Verse 12 says, "This made the king so angry and furious that he ordered the execution of all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death, and men were sent to look for Daniel and his friends to put them to death." Which lets you know that Daniel and his friends weren't at this meeting. So it wasn't all of the wise men of Babylon who were called in, but all of the wise men of Babylon were to be put to death. It was a bad time to be a wise man in Babylon, wasn't it? And this is where Daniel makes his initial appearance in this chapter. Beginning in verse 14, Daniel exhibited an impressive demeanor. More than anything, I want you to concentrate on how Daniel responds. Beginning in verse 14. "When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death the wise men of Babylon, Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact." All right, remember, he's a teenager, right? Daniel is still a teenager at this point. How much life experience did he really have to pull from? How much wisdom and tact had he been able to develop at that young age? But he did. And I don't know about you, I'm not sure that I would have responded in wisdom and tact if the police came by and said, "Oh, by the way, you're about to be put to death." Wisdom and tact would probably be the last ways I would react in that situation. But Daniel did. And he asked Arioch, "Why'd the king issue such a harsh decree?" And Arioch explained the matter to Daniel. At this, Daniel went into the king and asked for time that he might interpret the dream for him. That's one of those verses, it's really easy to read and kind of pass through to get on to the next thing. But just stop and linger over that for a moment. Daniel says, "Take me into the king, the same guy who just signed my death warrant, because I want to talk to him." And what does he do when he gets there? He asks for time. The very thing that ticked off Nebuchadnezzar in the first place, when all of his astrologers asked for more time, he's like, "Yeah, you're just buying time. Forget it." What does that mean? That means Daniel had some sanctified guts. This took some real courage on his part to go into the very man who ordered his death and say, just give me a little time. And I'm sure that he did it with wisdom and tact. Because I'm sure if he went in and said, "Hey, king, what do you think you're doing? You didn't even give me a chance," he wouldn't have got another word out of his mouth. But he goes in calmly, yet asserts, "If you give me some time, I'll get your answer." And something must have worked, because he gave Daniel time where he didn't give his astrologers and magicians and enchanters time. We're not told how much time. I'm guessing it wasn't a lot. It might have been, I'll give you till morning. I don't know. Probably not a lot of time, but Daniel was given some time. I'm reminded of that Rudyard Kipling poem, "If you can keep your head when all about are losing theirs." That's what Daniel did. He was able to keep himself composed. He was able to keep his head about him. And so, he's given some time. He goes back to his friends. He explained the matter to his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. I find it fascinating they're given their Hebrew names here, not their Babylonian names. He urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that he and his friends might not be executed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. What do they immediately do? They go to prayer. They don't say, hey, let's get the scrolls out and see if we can figure this out for ourselves. No, they go to prayer. They immediately go to God and say, God, you are the only one who can do this. You are the only hope we have. And they prayed to God. And verse 19 says that during the night, Daniel received his answer in a vision. Now, I don't know about you, but if I was in that situation, and it's 2:30 in the morning, and God gives me the answer that's going to save my life, my friends, and all my colleagues, I would have immediately gone and said, wake up the king, I got the answer. That's not what Daniel did. Notice verse 20. Then Daniel praised the God of heaven and said, praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons. He sets up kings and deposes them. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what lies in darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and power. You have made known to me what we asked of you. You have made known to us the dream of the king. This little psalm here is just a model of thanksgiving, isn't it? Daniel gives praise and thanks to God. And the focus is clearly on God, his wisdom and power. Daniel's taking no credit for what has happened. He refers to the Lord 13 times in those few verses. He refers to himself only 5. And when he does, he's saying, I thank you. I praise you. The emphasis is all on God. What incredible maturity for such a young man. And then we read in verse 24. Then Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to execute the wise men of Babylon, and said to him, do not execute the wise men of Babylon. Take me to the king, and I will interpret his dream for him. So Arioch took Daniel to the king at once and said, I have found a man among the exiles from Judah who can tell the king what his dream means. Pfft, what a joke. Arioch didn't find Daniel. Daniel found him. You're always going to have people that are trying to hog the light, right? Oh, look what I did. You know, Daniel isn't about that. Daniel didn't care who got the credit as long as God got the glory. Big lesson from this chapter. Doesn't matter who gets the credit as long as God gets the glory. So the king answered Daniel, also called Belteshazzar, are you able to tell me what I saw in my dream and interpret it? And Daniel replied, no wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he has asked about. And I'm sure about this time Nebuchadnezzar is saying, ah, here we go again. More excuses, more begging for time. This guy's no better than the rest of them. But Daniel went on. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in days to come. Your dream and the visions that you pass through your mind as you lay on your bed are these. And then he goes and explains the dream. We're not going to get into that today. We don't have time. That's for another message. Basically, It was a dream about the future. Later on in the chapter, Daniel says, the great God has shown the king what will take place in the future. The dream is true and the interpretation is trustworthy. So it's about the future. I like how my Old Testament professor, Dave O'Brien, summed it up. Daniel 2 tells us that human greats give way to greater humans and that nothing human lasts. That's about it. There are great people and they pass from the scene, and then more great people come and they pass from the scene, and nothing lasts forever. That's the dream in a nutshell. But what I really want to focus on is the impressive demeanor that Daniel exhibited. In these verses, you see Daniel exhibit great grace with boldness. He had a sense of tact, but he also had a sense of rightness. He had a calm assertiveness that we need in times like this. He's not afraid to use the kind of language that had previously enraged the king. Humans are dust, Daniel says. It's beyond their natural powers to do what the king has asked, but there's a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. All through this address by Daniel, you see the same God-centeredness. God is in heaven. God gave the dream. God gives the answer. Now look down at verse 30. As for me, this mystery has been revealed to me not because I have greater wisdom than other living men, but that so you, O king, may know the interpretation, you may understand what went through your mind. Even with the answer, Daniel is not saying, look at me. He's not saying, hey, I'm the great one. I got the answer. All your other advisors didn't. Again, he doesn't care who gets the credit as long as God gets the glory. I'm impressed by this. To me, it's amazing how Daniel did this. And he was a teenager. Very impressive. In fact, it sounds a lot like a story in Genesis 41 where another young man named Joseph was in another very similar situation and was able to tell the Pharaoh his dream and what it meant. Why? Because it's the same God. Same God was at work. And then in verses 46 through 49, go down to the end of the chapter, Daniel experienced an implausible deliverance. I don't think anybody saw this coming. You know, when the word goes out, all the wise men are to be put to death. Thought that was the end, but it's not the end. Verse 46 says, then Nebuchadnezzar fell prostrate before Daniel and paid him honor and ordered that an offering and an incense be presented to him. The king said to Daniel, surely your God is the God of gods and Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you are able to reveal this mystery. Isn't it amazing? Even pagan King Nebuchadnezzar gave glory to God. And I think that's because of how Daniel went about it. Then the king placed Daniel in a high position and lavished many gifts on him, made him ruler over the entire province of Babylon, and placed him in charge of all the wise men. So all the guys that couldn't come up with the dream, he's now put in charge. Let me say it again. As a teenager, that's going to come back later in the book of Daniel. Trust me. Just keep that in the back of your mind. Moreover, at Daniel's request, the king appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego administrators over the province of Babylon, while Daniel himself remained at the royal court. And that's just setting up for chapter 3, which we'll look at next week. But who would have thought that this Jewish teenager would have showed up all the Ivy League graduates of his day? Literally saved their lives as well as his own. I'm sure it seemed implausible to say the least. Now, that's looking at it from a historical perspective. We know from a theological view it was God who came through. It was God who revealed the dream and the interpretation and saved the day. And you'll notice that Daniel had that perspective as well. It's all about what God has done. So what can we take from this story when the heat is on in our lives? When Daniel encountered an impossible demand, he exhibited an impressive demeanor and he experienced an implausible deliverance. How did he do it? I would suggest he did it with a calm assertiveness. He didn't panic. He didn't get all emotional. But he didn't stand idly by and let himself and his colleagues be exterminated. He exercised great wisdom and tact and boldness with everyone he encountered. Even the king, who had sentenced him to death, he went in and said, "If you give me some time, I'll get you your answer." He displayed an unwavering confidence, but that confidence wasn't in himself, it was in his God. When threatened, Daniel brought his friends together and they prayed. And their prayers were answered. And when they were answered, they first thanked God and worshiped him, even before they acted on it. When he revealed the content and the interpretation of the dream, he didn't care who got the credit as long as God got the glory. But he was rewarded in the end for all that he did. I say when the heat is on, we need that calm assertiveness. I know some people don't like the word assertive. It doesn't have to be negative. You can be humble and assertive. You can display what the Puritans used to call a holy boldness. And it's holy because it's humble. It's relying upon God. I want to leave you with a passage from the New Testament. If you're into memorizing scripture, I would highly recommend you memorize this one. And if you don't, you can at least remember where to find it. Really easy. If you can remember Corinthians, then remember 2, 3, 4, 5. 2 Corinthians 3, verses 4 and 5. Paul writes, "Such confidence as this is ours through Christ before God. Not that we are competent to claim anything for ourselves, but our competence comes from God." Paul was confident, but he wasn't conceited. He was assured, but he wasn't arrogant. Why? Because he knew that his confidence lay in God, not in himself. Because I know a lot of Christians that think in order to be humble, you got to go around saying, "I'm nothing, I can't do nothing." That's not humility. In fact, it's not even honesty. Humility is not thinking lowly of yourself. Humility is not thinking about yourself. You're thinking about God. You're thinking about other people. That's true humility. And when you are confident in what God is doing and what God will do, that will give you that calm assertiveness when the heat is on. That's what we need. Keep your head while others are losing theirs. Remember that God is ultimately in control. Pray for wisdom and courage, and don't forget to thank him when he answers. Stand up for Jesus. Just be smart about it. Use wisdom and tact instead of force and emotion. Don't worry who gets the credit, as long as God gets the glory.